Dear ladies and gentlemen, okay. Dear ladies and gentlemen, both free and open-minded software community, is this okay? I'm very proud and honored to announce Richard Stallman as our this year's keynote speaker. Richard Stallman, widely known as RMS in the internet and the software community, founded in the 1980s the Free Software Foundation and initiated and developed important software like, for example, the new C compiler thing and the Emacs editor, which I really like and prefer. Not only because he's standing right next to me.
Oh, it's the new FUBAR program from Carnegie Mellon. Todd, say, or from Stanford, or and in the FUBAR directory. And at that point, you can go to that directory, and you find the executable that you could run. You'd also find the source code, which you could study, so you could learn how they solve those problems. And then in running the executable, if you discovered bugs or you had ideas for new features, you could go to the source code and fix the bugs or add the features. You could even cut pieces out of the source code to use them in some other program you were writing. This we call cannibalizing the old program. Nowadays, some academics have a highfalutin word for it. They call it code reuse. And they make extensive studies of what it takes to enable code reuse. Well, we knew the most important thing was make sure the code was available there. So you could use the program in all the various ways that it could be useful, not only by running it. And so programs were passed from one person to another, built on perhaps for 15 years. They grew the way a city grows. For example, at one point we needed a cross-assembler that would generate code for the PDP-11 and would run on the PDP-10, which was our main computer. The PDP-11 was a much smaller computer. And we didn't really want to use it for time sharing or anything, or develop a whole system for it. We just used it as an I/O processor. So we could have just written this cross-assembler, but to save time was better to look around. So I went over to Harvard, where I was a student. At their PDP-10 lab, they had a suitable cross-assembler. It was written, I believe, by somebody working for Digital. They had the source code, and there was no copyright notice on it. So I brought it over to MIT and started fixing it up, because it was written to run on Digital's time-sharing system, and we needed it to run on our time-sharing system, the incompatible time-sharing system, or ITS. That was the operating system written by hackers for hackers. So I changed it to run on ITS, and I added some more macro features so that we could get the job done using the assembler more conveniently. And then we used it for a few years. And then somebody at BBN, a company, needed such a cross-assembler that would run on their PDP-10 time-sharing system, 10X. So he contacted me, I sent him a copy, he ported it to 10X and added additional macro features. And then we merged the two versions into one common version with conditionals for the two systems and all of the features. And we maintained and used that together for another few years, until those computers were just obsolete. And this is the way our community functioned. But then I got a taste of what life was like for most computer users, the computer users behind the shrink wrap curtain who are using proprietary software. This happened when Xerox gave MIT a laser printer. Now, this was a very nice gift in some ways. This was the first generation laser printer. It was the first time anybody outside Xerox ever had a laser printer. It was really a high-speed office copier that had been modified to with a computer attachment so it would be a printer. It was very fast. It printed a page a second. It was high resolution. and the straight lines came out nice and straight and sharp, but it was also unreliable. It frequently got paper jams. Now, if somebody was using it for office copying, there'd be a person there to fix the jam. But as a printer, there was nobody to fix the jam, you see. So the thing would be jammed for long periods of time and nobody would know. Well, we knew what to do about this problem because our previous printer, which was slow and low resolution and tended to make vertical lines come out a bit wavy, was also unreliable. What's funny about that? Boy, I can't fail to get a laugh with this audience. You're helping me prepare for my career change. I've always wanted to be a comic. Anyway, we couldn't improve the old printer itself, so we added features to the software that controlled the old printer to compensate for the shortcomings of the hardware. We were able to do this because the old printer was controlled by free software. It ran on a PP11 and we assembled it with that cross assembler. And so we could add any features we needed, limited only by our abilities. So we added a feature that every time a print job finished, the PDP-11 would notify the PDP-10, and the PDP-10 would display a message on the screen of the user who had printed that job, saying, your file foo has been printed. Thus, you had to wait because the printer was slow, but you didn't have to wait extra just because you didn't know when the job was done. And there was another feature that I added myself, which was when the printer got in trouble, the PDP-11 would tell the PDP-10, which would search the print queue, and it would make a list of all the users currently waiting for printing, and it would display a message for each of them saying, the printer is in trouble, go fix it. Well, if you got that message, you would know that only a few people were getting that message. So you couldn't assume someone else would fix it. No, you wanted your printout to come out, you would go to the printer. So a minute after the printer got in trouble, two or three people would arrive there. One of them at least would know how to fix the problem and would teach the others. Is there a laughing gas leaking in the It's got to be some kind of drug that you're on. So, when we saw the problems of the new printer, of course we thought of fixing them the same way. But there we ran into a brick wall because the new printer was controlled by proprietary Xerox printer software on a proprietary Xerox mini computer. We didn't have the source code and we were completely helpless to make any kind of changes. And so because of that, using the printer was constantly frustrating. You type the command to print a file, and then you go back to work. And a while later, you notice time. Oh, it's been half an hour, not long enough. It's probably not printed yet. So you go back to work. And a while later, you notice time. Oh, it's been an hour. Maybe it's printed now. So you'd walk upstairs to the printer, and you'd see that it had been jammed the whole time. So, you'd fix the jam, and you'd go back to work. And a while later, you'd notice the time. Oh, it's been half an hour. Maybe it's printed now. So you'd go back to the printer, and you'd see that it printed 200 pages of other people's stuff, which was 3 minutes for that fast printer, and then jammed again. This is not funny. This was very frustrating. And so, at that point, you would fix the jam and you'd say, I'm going to stand here and fix this damn printer every time it jams until my printout comes out. It wasn't supposed to work that way, but because the people at Xerox were deliberately obstructing us, that's what we were stuck with. We were prisoners of our software. Now, Xerox had given us a very nice gift by giving us a printer. I couldn't say that they owed it to us to do work on the software as well. I understood they had their own jobs to do. But they should at least have let us fix our own problems. To refuse to do that was deliberately nasty. They were going out of their way to hamper us. And that was galling every time we had this frustration to realize we could have fixed it, but somebody else was stopping us. I have no doubt that we could have fixed it. And we had developed our own Ethernet-like network. We could certainly have added the features to this software to communicate the messages that were needed. Anyway, by and by, I heard that somebody at Carnegie Mellon had a copy of that software. Eventually, I was in Pittsburgh, so I went to his office and I said, hi, I'm from MIT. Could I have a copy of the printer control software source code? And he said, no, I promised not to give you a copy. I was so shocked, I didn't know how to express how angry I was. All I could do was turn around and storm out of his office without saying anything to him. But I thought about it afterwards. You see, this was very bad for us at the MIT AI lab, because we never got a copy of that software. We were never able to add those features, and the printer continued to be frustrating for all the years we kept using it. But in a paradoxical way, it was very good for me, because it taught me an important lesson, a lesson that's even more important because most programmers don't learn it. You see, he had promised to refuse to give me a copy of the source code. But he promised to refuse to help me and my colleagues and his colleagues at MIT. But he didn't just do that to us. He probably did it to you too. And I think most likely he did it to you too. And chances are he did it to you too. In fact, he probably did it to most of the people here in this room, except maybe a few of you weren't born yet in 1980. Because he had done this, he had promised to refuse his help to just about everybody alive in the world. He had betrayed essentially the whole world. He had signed a non-disclosure agreement. Now, this was my first direct encounter with a non-disclosure agreement. I was the victim. I and my whole lab were the victims. And the lesson it taught me was that non-disclosure agreements have victims. Now, most people first encounter non-disclosure agreements when they're invited to sign one. And there's always some kind of temptation, some goodie that you're going to get if you sign. So people make up excuses to silence their consciences. They say, they're never going to get copies anyway, so why shouldn't I help deprive them? They say, this is the way it's always done. Who am I to go against it? They say, if I don't do this, somebody else will. All sorts of excuses to participate in a system of betrayal. But when I was invited to sign a non-disclosure agreement, I remembered how angry I was when I and my whole lab were the victims of one. And I couldn't turn around and do the same exact thing to somebody else who probably would deserve it as little as we had. So I said, "Thank you very much for offering me this nice software package, but I can't accept it in good conscience under the conditions that you have set. So I'm going to do without it. Thank you very much, but no thanks." And so I have never knowingly signed a non-disclosure agreement for generally useful technical information, the stuff of science and engineering and technology. Now, there are other kinds of information. For example, there's personal information. That raises a completely different set of moral issues. If you wanted to ask to talk with me about what was happening between you and your girlfriend, and you asked me, please don't tell anybody else, I could agree to that. Because that's not generally useful technical information. It might be. You know, if you were to tell me about some marvelous new sex technique, I might feel the moral duty to pass it on to humanity, some of you who might be able to make use of it. But if you were talking about, you know, what you were arguing about and how you disagreed and how you were hurting each other and what you tried to do about it, and those are not things, those details, that will help other people live their lives better. So it's okay for me to keep it private for you. But when it comes to useful technical information, how to do things, the purpose of science and engineering is to develop that information for humanity. If we withhold it from humanity, we are betraying the mission of our field. And this, I vowed, I would not do. But about the same time I was making that decision, and I realized, of course, that the non-disclosure agreement that I was the victim of was not the only non-disclosure agreement. If it was just a matter of one jerk, I probably wouldn't have paid so much attention to it. But I knew that I was getting a taste of the usual way, of the usual social system that most computer users felt compelled to live in. And so I realized I was getting first-hand experience with a major moral issue for my field. But about the same time that I made the vow that I would not sign those non-disclosure agreements, a series of calamities was falling on my community, which ended up wiping it out. Perhaps the final nail in the coffin came when Digital discontinued the PDP-10. ITS was developed starting in the 1960s. It was written, therefore, in assembler language for the PDP-10. When that architecture was discontinued, all of our years of work turned into dust and blew away. And the only way you could get a modern operating system to run on a modern computer was to sign a non-disclosure agreement, because all the operating systems were proprietary. And this meant that it was impossible for me to continue in my field of operating system development without betraying the moral decision I had made. Well, this was a substantial moral dilemma. What could I do? Well, because I couldn't continue working as I had done before. That option had been taken away. It depended on being part of the community, and the community was gone. Well, what could I do? The most obvious option was to accept the way the world had changed, to swallow my principles and just go along with it. I would have had to start signing non-disclosure agreements and using proprietary software, and I'm sure MIT would have had me developing proprietary software too, because MIT had already done things like that. MIT had already turned the software developed by its staff into proprietary software products. I realized that this way I could have fun coding, and I could make money, especially if I left MIT and did it somewhere else. But at the end of my career, I would have to look back in shame and say, I have spent my life building walls to divide people. And I didn't want that to happen. So I looked for another alternative. And there was, and I pretty quickly found another alternative, which was I could leave the computer field, do something else. Now, many programmers seem to think this is impossible. They tell me, the people who hire programmers demand this, this, and this. If I don't do them, I'll starve. That's literally the word they use. Even in the United States, even today, there are millions of people who make a living not in the computer field. Well, what nonsense is that? Now, I had no other special skills, but I'm sure I could have become a waiter. Not in a fancy restaurant, I guess, but I could have been a waiter. Now, being a waiter doesn't involve doing anything unethical. It's perfectly legitimate morally. And one thing about being a waiter is you're not going to starve. But I realized that being a waiter would be no fun at all for me, and it would be wasting my skills as an operating system developer. It would avoid abusing my skills, but it would still be wasting them. So for those two reasons, I looked for some other alternative. What can an operating system developer do to use those skills in a way that would make the situation better? And I realized that an operating system developer was exactly what we needed, because the problem, the dilemma, existed because all of the available operating systems for modern computers were proprietary. If an operating system developer wrote another operating system and then made it free, encouraged everyone to share it, that would create a third way out of the dilemma, not just for me, but for every computer user. And I realized this was what I had to do. It was a big job, and I didn't know if it was possible to finish it. Of course, other people said that it was too big and I couldn't ever finish it. And I had to recognize maybe they were right, but at least it was worth trying to do. Whereas developing proprietary software is not worth trying to do, because even if you succeed, you've only done harm. So I decided I would try to develop a free operating system. Well, the next question was, what should the design of this system be? Now, I had just seen one free operating system turn into dust and blow away, because it was written for a particular computer that was discontinued. I didn't want that to happen again. So I decided that this system had better be portable. Well, at the time, I only knew of one portable operating system that was actually a success and had real user communities on various different computer architectures. And that was Unix. Unix also has some good ideas in it, advanced by the standards of the time. For example, pipes, I/O redirection, the simple fork and exec system calls, shell programming. So I figured this is a pretty good system to imitate, and I decided we would follow the design of Unix, and that way have a better chance of producing something that would really be usable and really be portable. Furthermore, I decided to make the system upward compatible with Unix, because I realized that compatibility is, strictly speaking, to users. I could have taken the best ideas from the operating systems I had helped to develop, plus the other good ideas from the systems I had used or read about, and then added my own favorite ideas and produced my dream operating system. But I knew that if I showed this system to the users, they would say, well, this is very nice, but it's incompatible. We've already developed our programs to run on Unix, and it would be a big job to make them run on your system. We haven't got time, so no thank you. Well, my goal was to build a community where a lot of users would really enjoy the benefits of Liberty, not just to make an excuse for myself. So, yeah, I could have said, well, I offered them the system and they said no, now it's their fault, but that would just be an excuse. So instead I decided I better make sure that the system is such that they will decide to use it. So I decided to make it compatible with Unix. Now, Unix consisted and still consists of many small to medium-sized components that communicate by documented interfaces. So being compatible with Unix means you have to replace each of these components one by one. And that means all of the initial general design decisions have been made, except one: which class of target machines are you going to aim for? Now, Unix had been designed to run on 16-bit machines. That limits the address space that's available and makes it a lot of extra work. I figured it would take several years to get the system written, and by the time we were done, I figured 32-bit machines would be cheap enough that everybody would have them, or could have them. So I decided not to bother trying to squeeze the programs into 16-bit machine address spaces. We would only target 32-bit machines. And it, as it turns out, this prediction did come to pass. But other than that, the decisions were made, so, and in fact, with this design, different people could write the replacements for these different components, which would make it much more suitable for the kind of volunteer effort that this would have to be. So we could start work, in fact. The only thing we needed was a name. Now, we hackers always love to find funny or naughty names for programs, because that's half the fun of developing a program and thinking about how people's reaction to the name. Now, being a hacker means you do things in a spirit of playful cleverness. A bit like a child, actually. And so, of course, we pick playful, clever names. Well, there was a hacker tradition that when you're developing a program which is similar to some existing program, you can give the new one a name, which is a recursive acronym, saying that this one is not the other one. For example, in the 60s and 70s, there were many Tico text editors, and most of them were called this Tico or that Tico or whatchamacallit Tico, but one clever hacker called his version TINT, which stood for TINT is not Tico, the first recursive acronym. Then in 1975, I developed the first Emacs editor. And there were many imitations of Emacs, and some were called this Emacs, or that Emacs, or who's he, what's this Emacs. But one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And there was Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And then Ina was almost completely rewritten. And the new version was called, I'm sure you'll be glad to know, Zwei. Or Zwei was Ina initially. So I decided, for want of any better idea, I decided to look for a recursive acronym name for something is not Unix. But I tried all the obvious four-letter possibilities, all 26 of them, and I saw that none of them was a word. And if it wasn't a word, it wasn't going to be funny. So I tried another way to make a recursive acronym. I tried making a contraction, and I discovered that the word GNU, which is one of the most humor-laden words in the English language, could serve. It could stand for GNU is not Unix. You see, the reason why the word GNU is used for so many jokes is that according to the dictionary, it's supposed to be pronounced GNU, just like the word for something that's the opposite of old, right? So people are constantly making plays on words using GNU instead of NEW. There's even a funny song about that word. What? I don't know the song well enough to sing it. I only know it. I figured with such a humor-laden word, how could anything be better? So I picked that name. By the way, I should explain the reason why the dictionary has such a strange thing in it. This is the name of an animal that lives in Africa. And I believe the native word has a click sound in it. I don't know precisely how to make that click sound, but in any case, the British colonists didn't bother trying. So they just pronounced it new, and they wrote it with a G, meaning there's something else here that we are not pronouncing. And then somebody else British who was writing a dictionary said, British people spell it this way and pronounce it this way, so I will list them in the dictionary and say that anything else is wrong. In any case, when it's the name of our operating system, please pronounce a hard G. Pronounce it GNU. If you speak of the new operating system, you'll get people very confused. Especially since we've been working on it for 16 years now, so it's not new anymore. But it still is, and always will be, GNU, no matter how many people mistakenly call it Linux. So, I posted an announcement on the net, and in January 1984, I quit my job at MIT to start developing GNU. I had to quit because I wanted to make sure MIT would not be able to claim to own my work and turn it into proprietary software. I didn't want to have to beg for permission for approval for the specific details of my plans for how to release the software. And the only way I could stop MIT from interfering was to quit my job, and I have never had a job since then. So I went into Professor Winston's office, and he said, "You still want to quit?" "Yes." "You want to keep your key?" "Okay." So I began using develop GNU. Now, this was the first time I actually started using Unix. I was never a Unix wizard the way some other people were. I just chose Unix because it seemed like a good choice for this job. So at that point, I got to see Unix up close with all its warts and wrinkles. But fortunately, they weren't too bad. I decided it was still a good idea to imitate Unix. Now, at the time, I thought that we would develop all of these different components, and then when we had all of them, we would release this complete system, and then users would start to use it. But that's not what happened. In September 1984, I started developing GNU Emacs, which was my second implementation of the extensible text editor. And by early 1985, it was working well enough that I could do all my editing with it, which was very convenient because it meant I could edit on the Unix machine. I had no intention of learning to use VI. So I did all my editing on another machine and saved the files through the network. But once GNU Emacs was running, I could do my editing on the Unix machine. But when it was good enough for me, it was good enough for other people too. Other people wanted to get copies and use it. So they started sending me mail asking me for copies. And that meant I had to work out the details of how I was going to distribute GNU Emacs. Well, of course, I put a copy in the anonymous FTP directory on the Unix machine I was using. But that was only good for people who were on the network. In 1985, most American programmers were not on the network. So when I got mail from them sent through UMCP, the question was, how should I respond? I could have said, I want to spend my time writing more GNU software, not writing tapes. So please find a friend who's on the net who's willing to download it for you and put it on a tape for you. And I'm sure the people who really wanted it would have got copies by and by. But I had no job, and I was looking for some way I could make money by developing free software. So I posted an announcement, send me $150 and I'll mail you a tape of Emacs. So I started a free software business. And the orders began dribbling in. By the middle of the year, they were trickling in. I was getting 8 to 10 orders a month, which was actually enough. It would have been barely enough for me to make a living on, to live on if necessary. And the reason is that I always lived cheaply. I just don't want to get stuck with expensive habits, so I just thought, I'm just not going to get those things. If I don't pick up the expensive habits, then I don't even have to watch how much I'm spending, because I never spend very much. Most Americans, of course, once they start making some money, they immediately say, how can I spend this much money? So they start buying houses and cars and boats and rare stamps and artwork and adventure travel and children. And they also have expensive things and they become addicted to them and they can't give them up. And then they say, well, then I have to do whatever the people with the money demand. They become effectively puppets of money. Money is dictating their whole lives. They spend all the time working, doing whatever somebody will pay for. They have to throw away their consciences too. You know, they don't even have much time to drive those cars or sail those boats or play with those children or whatever. It all just seems stupid. decide what you want to do with your life instead of letting money decide for you. But people sometimes say to me, what do you mean it's free software if it costs $150? They thought they were so clever. Well, the English word free has multiple meanings. One of these meanings refers to price, and the other refers to freedom. Another refers to freedom. When I speak of free software, I'm talking about free speech. I'm talking about freedom, not price. So think of free speech, not free beer. Some people paid me for copies of GNU Emacs. And some people got their copies of GNU Emacs from me through the network without paying anything. And some people got their copies indirectly through other people. Maybe they paid the other people, but they didn't pay me. But all of these people had certain crucial freedoms, and that's what made GNU Emacs free software. The important thing is the freedom, not whether people paid me money or not. Now, I have not sworn a vow of poverty, and I don't mind getting paid money. I don't mind getting paid money for copies of GNU Emacs or by people who like GNU Emacs. But I have not been doing all this work with the goal that programmers should not be paid. I'm happy for other programmers to be paid. But it is essential that everyone using the software have freedom. That's the most important issue, and that's what all this work is about. So let me now give the precise definition of free software. A program is free software for you, a particular user, if you have the following freedoms. Boy, this is taking a lot longer than it usually takes to get to this point. Wonder what makes, I don't understand why. A program is free software for you if you have the following freedoms. Freedom 0 is the freedom to run the program for any purpose. Freedom 1 is the freedom to help yourself by modifying the program to suit your needs. Freedom 2 is the freedom to help your neighbor by distributing copies of the program. And Freedom 3 is the freedom to help build your community by publishing improved versions of the program so other people can benefit from your work. If you have all of these freedoms, the program is free software for you. Now, Freedom 0 is something that most software will give you. So, any program which doesn't give you Freedom 0 is particularly restricted. In addition, any Freedom 0 follows legally as a consequence of Freedoms 1, 2, and 3. So I don't have to say very much about Freedom 0. The freedoms that distinguish free software from typical software are Freedoms 1, 2, and 3. So let me explain those freedoms in more detail and talk more about the reasons why they are important. Freedom 1 is the freedom to help yourself by changing the software to suit your needs. This could mean fixing bugs, it could mean adding features, it could mean translating all the messages into German, it could mean porting it to run on a different computer system. Any kind of change you could imagine, that's what I mean in this freedom. Now, in order, practically speaking, to be able to make changes easily, you need to have the source code. So, you know, without the source code, even the simplest changes are a horrible pain in the neck. You know, even just changing it to use 4 digits instead of 2 digits for the year can be awfully hard without the source code. So, practically speaking, availability of source code is a necessary condition for free software. Now, who can take advantage of this freedom? Well, anybody who can program, anybody who's a programmer can take advantage of it. But also, any businesses that use software can take advantage of this freedom. Because, you know, maybe the business doesn't do anything, isn't in the computer field, maybe there's no programmer working in the company, but if you want to change, maybe you just go to a programming company and say, how much will you charge to make this change for me? Just as a business, if they want to move the walls inside their building, they go to a carpenter. They don't have to have carpenters in the company. Likewise, if they want their computer system changed, they can go to the people who specialize in that. But in addition, this freedom is also useful to anybody who cares about privacy and security in their computer system. Because with typical proprietary software, you can't tell for yourself what's being done in the program. You can only take it on faith. So if you're concerned that there be no bugs that open security holes, if you're concerned about possible malicious backdoors, you can't check for either one. Whereas with free software, you can check. So accidental bugs are more likely to be caught and fixed. And deliberate backdoors, well, people are less likely to dare to try them if they know that somebody else might see what they've done. So, for any program that's part of your privacy and security, it's very important that it be free software. And of course, when your computer is on a network, every program on it is important for the privacy and security. But, you know, even people who are not programmers can still make use of this freedom. Because there are easy programming jobs and there are hard ones. If you don't become a professional programmer or good enough to be one, then you won't be able to do the hard jobs. But any intelligent person can learn a little easy programming and do a few easy jobs when he wants to. The first time that an Emacs editor was implemented in Lisp, that was Multics Emacs, they wrote a manual explaining how to extend Multics Emacs, which was really an introduction to programming in Lisp, but it didn't say that's what it was. And then the author was amazed to discover that the secretaries in the lab had read this book and had started programming in Lisp. Now, he believes that if the book had said programming in Lisp for extending Emacs, the secretaries would have looked at it and said, programming? I can't possibly learn programming. But because they didn't know that what they were learning was programming, they dared to try and they learned it. So it's important not to underestimate ordinary users of computers. Now, it's wrong to say, oh, of course, you don't want to busy your heads trying to understand these arcane secrets. Just leave everything to us. That is the priesthood of technology, and that's wrong. With free software, we allow anyone to read the holy source code. So, if you don't have freedom number one, that causes practical material harm. You become a prisoner of your software. I already explained what that was like in regard to the Xerox laser printer, so I won't repeat it. But it also causes psychosocial harm, which affects people's morale, their enthusiasm for their work. Now, if you're excited about the work you're doing, and you come into work, and every day it's hard because somebody is forcing you to use bad, painful tools, and you're not allowed to improve matters, that's going to be constant frustration. And people respond to constant frustration by protecting themselves, by they stop caring. So they end up with an attitude like, Well, I showed up for work today. I brought my book. If I can't get work done, I'll just get paid for reading my book. It makes no difference to me. That's low morale, and that's harmful to society and to the people it happens to. So that's freedom number one, the freedom to help yourself by making changes in the program. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor by distributing copies of the program, sharing the program with other people. For beings that can think and know things, sharing knowledge is a fundamental act of friendship. Because you can give your knowledge to somebody else without losing it yourself. When these beings use computers, this act of friendship takes the form of sharing software. If people do not have this freedom, that causes practical material harm. It causes waste. The program goes to waste. If the program has an owner who succeeds, and never mind how, in establishing a situation where each user must pay to use the program, then some people will say, well, this creates a financial disincentive, discouraging people from using the program. So some people will say, all right, I'll pay, and they'll use the program. While others will say, it's too much, never mind, I'll do without it. And every time somebody says, never mind, I'll do without it, the program is going to waste. Somebody who wanted to use it is not using it. But the work it takes to develop the program to any given level of power and quality is the same regardless of the number of users. So the same work is done, but only part of the benefit is obtained by society. This, the rest of it, is waste, deliberately inflicted waste. So that's practical material harm, but along with that practical material harm, there is psychosocial harm, which affects the spirit of goodwill, which is the most important resource of society, which makes the difference between a livable society and the dog-eat-dog jungle. The spirit of goodwill, the willingness to help your neighbor, the feeling of that it's a good thing to do and that you want to do it, is essential for having a decent society. It's so important that the world's major religions go out of their way to encourage it. And so to have major social institutions discouraging this, telling people that it's wrong to share with their neighbors, that poisons the resource. And that's something that society cannot afford. We need more of this goodwill, not less. Now, what happens when people start saying, if you share with your neighbor, you're a pirate. They're saying that sharing with your neighbor, teaching your neighbor, is the moral equivalent of attacking a ship on the seas and kidnapping or killing the passengers and crew. Do you believe that? I hope you don't. And if you don't, I urge you to reject the word pirate. If somebody else uses the word, you should say, I reject that word. That's a propaganda word. And what does it mean when our governments start putting people in prison for sharing? How much fear is it going to take to convince people not to share with their neighbors? Do you want that level of fear to permeate your society? I don't. And this is why I morally condemn non-free software, because it's telling people It's trying to frighten people out of sharing with their neighbors. If you look, well, first of all, the Soviet Union put a lot of effort into stopping people from sharing information, into stopping forbidden copying of information, which was known as samizdat. And they developed several methods to prevent this. Five methods. First, guarding every piece of copying equipment. Every copier had a guard whose job was to check what was being copied and make sure that there was no forbidden copying. Second, harsh punishments. Anyone getting caught doing forbidden copying would be put in prison for years. Then to catch people, they looked for informers. People were asked to rat on their co-workers and neighbors to the information police. And also they used collective responsibility. You're going to watch that group. If I catch any of them doing forbidden copying, you are going to prison, so watch them carefully. And they used propaganda starting in childhood, telling people that only horrible enemies of the people would ever do this forbidden copying. The United States today is using these same five methods to stop forbidden copying. First, guards on copying equipment. In the US, because human labor is expensive, they use robot guards. There is software that goes in your computer that checks for what you're copying and is designed to stop you from doing forbidden copying. And because of the Millennium of Terror Copyright Act, this is now a crime. It's a crime to turn off this software. I believe that there's an attempt to push something like this in Europe. I hope you will fight it. Second, harsh punishments. 5 years ago, if you just made copies of something and gave them out to your friends just to be nice, this was not a crime in the US. Today you could be put in prison for years for this. And they just decided to increase the standard of penalties. Apparently it takes a lot of fear to get people to stop sharing with their neighbors. Third, informers. There have been ads on television, ads in the subways in the US, asking for people to rat on their co-workers to the information police. It's very scary. Fourth, collective responsibility. In the US, this is done, the internet service providers have been conscripted to watch their customers. They are held responsible for what their customers post. And fifth, propaganda starting in childhood. Well, the way the US government put it, well, when I was a kid going to school, the teachers were trying to teach us to share. They said, if you bring candy to school, you can't just eat it all yourself. You have to share some with the other kids. Today, the US government is telling them to do the exact opposite. They're saying, their slogan is, say yes to licensing. So the teachers are supposed to say, oh, you brought software to school. Well, don't share. Sharing is wrong. Sharing means you're a pirate. I don't want to live in the middle of the battleground of the war on copying. I'm afraid it can be just as cruel and just as harmful and just as stupid as the war on drugs. So, this is why Freedom 2 is so especially important. I believe this is the most important of all the reasons why software should be free. But moving on now to freedom number three, the freedom to publish an improved version so others can benefit from your work. Well, people used to say to me, if the software is free, then nobody will get paid to work on it, so nobody will work on it. Well, that was a theory. Today we can compare it with observed fact, and we see that both steps in the argument are wrong. So probably hundreds of people are now getting paid to write free software, and B, tens of thousands of people are working on free software without getting paid, as part-time, as volunteers. So when I released the new Emacs and people started using it, they started sending me improvements in the mail. So I would get a message with a bug fix, and a message with a new feature, and another bug fix, and another new feature, and another, and another, and another, and so they were pouring in on me so fast that just taking advantage of all the help people were giving me was a big job. Microsoft doesn't have this problem. So, since then, people have noted this phenomenon, that when a free program becomes popular, you often get a community of people helping to improve it. And this is giving free software a reputation for being very powerful and reliable. There is even a group of people who have focused on this particular reason as the reason why users should be free to do these various things. That group, which I am not a member of, calls itself the open source movement. Now, the open source movement advocates more or less the same set of freedoms that we do in the free software movement. Not exactly the same. Their criteria are not exactly the same. So there are some programs that are open source but are not free software. However, the real big difference is that they have a strategy of choosing everything they say to appeal to business. And they have a theory that people in business have contempt for freedom and having a good society and everything like that. So they think that if they want to appeal to business, they have to shut up completely about those issues. So they never talk about those issues. They only cite practical advantages, like getting powerful, reliable software. Now, I think that what they say is valid as far as it goes. Those practical reasons are good reasons. But I think the most important reasons are the psychosocial reasons. Having a good society, I'd rather have some unreliable software if that meant I can live a free way of life as part of a community. I wouldn't give up my freedom just to get a fewer bugs. So, but you see, because we normally agree that freedom, in the questions where it is an issue, takes priority over these mere practical details, when people only talk about practical reasons, implicitly they are making the claim that freedom doesn't enter into it, into the question that they're talking about. So when you hear the open source movement talking about nothing but power and reliability, implicitly they are denying that there is a more important issue at stake here of freedom, community, principle, ethics. So that's where I disagree with the open source movement. Now, as for where you stand, that's up to you. If you wish to support either of this movement, of these two movements, or neither, or if you want to take some other position, that's up to you. But I would like to ask for your support for the free software movement. If you agree with me, I'd like to ask you to express your support for the free software movement by using our term free software, which is the banner of our movement. If you use the term open source, you're waving the banner of the open source movement. When you use the term free software, you're holding up the banner of the free software movement. If your views are sort of in between, well, you could hold up both banners and say you sort of support both, or, you know, whatever you want to do is up to you, but please keep in mind that we need your support, in fact, if you agree with us. If you support us, we need you to show it to other people. And this is why I ask people not to describe me or the GNU project or the GNU system as open source, because, you know, I want people to know that the GNU project was driven by the idealism of the free software movement. There are a lot of people who tell me that they think that this idealism is impractical. And sometimes these people are fans of the system we developed. Well, if only they knew the practical accomplishments that our idealism has had, it would be harder for them to call it impractical. They could still agree or disagree, but they couldn't make that criticism. So I want people to know this. Anyway, along with the practical harm, if you don't have freedom number three, that causes practical material harm, which is that this phenomenon of community improvement can't happen, and so the program doesn't become powerful and reliable in that way. But in addition, there's an associated psychosocial harm, which affects the spirit of scientific cooperation, which is in a great deal of danger nowadays with the commercial pressure on science. It needs all the help it can get. So these are the three freedoms that distinguish free software and the six reasons why they are important. If you, a particular user, have all of these freedoms, then the program is free software for you. Now, why do I define it in this way with respect to a particular arbitrarily chosen user? The reason is that sometimes the same software can be free for some users and non-free for others. Now, that might seem paradoxical, so let me give an example to show how it happens. The biggest example of this is the X window system. X was developed by a group at MIT and released with a license that made it free software. If you got a copy from MIT, you got all these freedoms. But among those who got copies from MIT were various computer manufacturers that distributed versions of Unix. So they took X, they made the comparatively small changes to get it to run on their computers, and they added the binaries to their Unix systems and distributed them under the same non-disclosure agreements as all the rest of Unix. And then hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of users got copies this way. But they didn't get any of these freedoms. And that was most of the users. Yes, some people got the MIT version and had freedom, but most of the users got their copies from the computer manufacturers and didn't have any freedom. So this created a paradoxical situation where, if you ask the question, is the X window system free software or not, the answer depended on where you made the measurement. If you made the measurement coming out of the developers group at MIT, you'd say, over here I observe all these freedoms, it's free software. If you made the measurement by looking at the users, you'd say, well, for the most part, I observe the absence of these freedoms. It is not free software. Well, the developers of X were not making a campaign for freedom. They wanted a professional success, and they got one. So they didn't consider this a state of affairs a problem. They thought they were being successful. But in the GNU project, we had a different goal. Our goal was actually to give the users freedom. If the same thing that happened to X had happened to GNU, GNU would have been a failure. So, now, X was started about the same time as GNU. So I hadn't seen this happen with X at the time, but I had seen it happen with other programs already. And I wanted to make sure that it didn't happen to GNU. So I looked for a way I could prevent it. And the method I developed is called copyleft. The idea of copyleft is it's a legal hack to use the existing legal system to protect the freedom for every user. And here's how it works. First, we say this program is copyrighted, which by default means that it's prohibited to copy or modify the program. But then we say you're permitted to copy and distribute this program. You're permitted to modify this program. You're permitted to distribute modified or extended or combined works. But there is a condition. And the condition is, whenever you redistribute anything that contains any part of this, you must do so under these terms, no more and no less. So you must pass along to others the same freedom that you got from me. This means that wherever the program goes, the freedom goes with it. In effect, we prohibit stripping off the freedom and passing along just the software without the freedom, which is what the computer manufacturers were doing with X and other programs. And the idea, therefore, is to make the freedom, these freedoms I described, into inalienable rights. That's a concept from the U.S. legal tradition. Rights that are so important that you can't give them up. Of course, not all software is copyleft, and we can only copyleft software if we're writing it. But I do the best I can. The specific implementation of copyleft that we use for most GNU software is the GNU General Public License. That's a particular implementation of copyleft. You can't use the general idea, just as you can't compile a program with the general idea of a compiler. You need a particular implementation. And likewise, you need a particular implementation of copyleft in order to do copyleft. We have a couple of other kinds of copyleft that we use for a few specific programs because they're more permissive. And in a few specific cases, that seems like the best strategy. We also now have a form of copyleft license designed specifically for manuals for free software and for other textbooks and explanations and documentation and reference works. It's called the GNU Free Documentation License. And I hope that this will stimulate interest among commercial publishers for publishing free copylefted manuals for free software. One of the big problems we have in the field today is that we have a lack of free documentation. There are publishers such as O'Reilly which are turning out lots and lots of non-free documentation, which is just as useless to us as non-free software. It would be a great contribution to our community if they contributed it, but they refuse. And that is a conspicuous example of doing the wrong thing. Anyway, I hope that the GNU Free Documentation License will make a change in this. I hope to see commercial publishers making a profit publishing free manuals. So there is copylefted free software, and there is non-copylefted free software, such as X Windows and Tech. They're all free software, though. They're all basically morally a good thing. I disagree with the developers of those other programs about the best strategy to use. But a disagreement about strategy is one thing, and saying that they're doing something wrong is another. It is free software, and we can use it in our free operating systems. And basically, it is a contribution to society. The disagreement is that with copyleft, in the non-copylefted case, they respect your freedom, but they won't actively try to defend it. In the copyleft case, we respect your freedom and we actively try to protect your freedom from anybody else who might want to take it away. Now, in a world where freedom is the exception rather than the norm, I think we ought to go further than just respecting other people's freedom. We should actively try to fight for other people's freedom. But I will not say that the people are doing something immoral if they don't fight for your freedom, but they do respect it themselves. So, throughout the 1980s, we were working to fill in all the various parts we needed to have a complete operating system. In October 1985, we started the Free Software Foundation, whose purpose was to raise money to contribute to this work. And it began hiring people to write pieces of GNU. Of course, sometimes somebody else wrote a program which could be a part of GNU. And I was always on the lookout for every possible opportunity to save work. You see, the project was so big, people said we could never do it. Obviously, we had to look for shortcuts. So anytime somebody else developed a program, which was free software, and could do part of the job, I said, let's use it. So for example, at the very Unix in 1984 did not have a Windows system, but I had done research on Windows systems before that, and I wanted GNU to have a Windows system. But fortunately, a few years later, I saw that X was available. It did the job, it was free software, so I said, okay, we'll use X. We won't develop our own GNU Windows system. So that's one big job that we saved. But that only happened by chance. And that still left lots of other components we had to do. So throughout the 1980s, we were writing these components or recruiting other people to write them. At a certain point, we had enough components written that I figured it would be good to make a list of what was missing. So I sat down with a Unix wizard and we developed what became the GNU task list. Initially, started off with a list of the pieces of Unix that were missing. Nowadays, we have all the pieces of Unix, but there are lots of application programs on this list because there are lots of applications that we need. After all, the operating system has to be the first thing. You can't use a computer without an operating system. The operating system has to be the first thing you get, but not the last. Once you've got a free operating system, now you want to do other jobs, so you should have free application programs. Every program you use on your computer should be free software, otherwise you're wearing a chain. By the early 1990s, the job was almost finished. We had almost all of the necessary components. Only one major essential component was still missing, and that was the kernel. We had started developing a kernel in 1990. That's the GNU Herd. And I chose a design that I thought would save us work. And that was we would use an existing microkernel that was already running as the lower level, And we would write the user programs to provide the other kernel services on top of that. But as it turns out, though, debugging those user programs to do the rest of the kernel job, because they are asynchronous multi-threaded programs that send messages to each other, it turned out to take ages to get them running. And the first test version was only released in 1996. But in the meantime, somebody else wrote a kernel using the tried-and-true monolithic design, and he got it to run much faster than that. And by, I think, 1992, he had it running. And this was Linux, which was developed by Linus Torvalds. So, well, we didn't know about Linux because he never communicated with us. But he did announce it elsewhere, and so some of the people who heard about it decided to look around and see if they could find the other parts of an operating system to put together with Linux. And they looked around, and lo and behold, everything they needed was already available. What good fortune, they thought, it's all here. But actually, there's no chance about it. They had found all the pieces of the GNU system waiting to be made into a complete system once we had a kernel. So in fact, what they were doing was fitting Linux into the kernel-shaped gap in the GNU system. But they didn't realize that. They thought they were taking these various pieces and putting them on top of Linux. So the appropriate name for what they produced was the combination of GNU and Linux. In other words, GNU slash Linux. But they, not realizing that, thought they were building a system on top of Linux, and so they called it a Linux system. Well, the development of Linux was a great step forward for free software, because it meant we attained our initial goal, the goal that we had announced back in 1983 of producing a complete free Unix-like operating system. But the mistake of calling the system as a whole Linux has been very harmful to the progress of free software, because it disconnected the GNU system from the GNU philosophy. See, it used to be until then that the software supported the philosophy and the philosophy supported the software. People used the GNU software, they knew that they were using GNU. So they would read about the GNU philosophy, and of course they might or might not agree, but if they did agree, then the software would have supported the philosophy. And then, when they agreed with the philosophy, they would be motivated to develop more free software for GNU. And so the philosophy supported the software. Each one carried the other. The effect, though, of the mistake of calling the GNU system, quote, Linux, unquote, was to cut this link. The people using GNU were no longer led to the GNU philosophy. Instead, they were led to the apolitical philosophy associated with Linux, the philosophy of Linus Torvalds, essentially. Now, he says that he is apolitical. Linus Torvalds doesn't believe that software should be free. He doesn't believe that these are ethical issues. In effect, his views are more or less the views of the open source movement. And he has the right to promote those views, of course. But it's a real shame that the GNU project's work is mistakenly promoting those other views, and that makes it hard for us to even get the attention of the people in the community today. The open source views are pretty good at getting people interested in developing more free software, but the support that they bring about does not have deep roots. And the reason is that people will make great sacrifices to fight for their freedom. But if it's just a matter of convenience, why make a sacrifice? Why undertake a big inconvenience to preserve a small convenience? That would be irrational. So if all you know to be at stake is convenience, practical expediency, that's not worth making a tremendous effort for. It's not worth facing adversity for. To do that, to motivate people to do that, we have to spread the word about freedom. But nowadays, if you look around our community, almost everywhere you look, you see the terms Linux and open source. You very rarely see anyone mentioning GNU and free software, the terms that are linked with freedom. In effect, calling the system Linux and using the term open source is very convenient for businesses that don't want people to think about their freedom very much. It's a way they can disconnect our work from our philosophy, which might be embarrassing to them. And this is why I ask people to make an effort to go out of their way to call the system GNU/Linux. That way, you're giving credit to the GNU project, the system's principal developer, and also giving credit to Linus Torvalds, because why shouldn't he get some credit too? If we look around in our community at the major institutions, we see that most of them use the terms Linux and open source. For example, if we look at the companies that distribute versions of the GNU/Linux system, most of them call the system Linux, and most of them use the term open source, and most of them add non-free software to their distributions. In fact, they all do. I skipped something. Basically, this issue is important. Oh boy, I skipped a lot. Excuse me, please forgive me. But sometimes people say to me, why make this fuss about credit? After all, the important thing is that the job is done. So it would be better, wiser for you to stop making a fuss about credit and just relax and be glad that the job is done, never mind who is being given credit for it. Well, that would be wise advice, except it's based on a misunderstanding of our present situation. We have only begun the job. We have a foothold on freedom. We have not secured our freedom permanently. Our community faces many threats, and unfortunately, most of the institutions in our community are not helping to prepare people to resist these threats. The biggest threat comes from the tendency to add non-free software to the system and treat it as part of the system. I've even got mail from people saying, well, the core of the system is free and the applications are proprietary, and that's ideal, that's how it should be. They've completely missed the point of free software. But most users never even hear it, so of course they miss the point. They've never been told the point. They don't see it anywhere around them. So if we look at these companies that distribute the GNU/Linux system and call it Linux, when they add non-free software to the system, They are spreading the idea that the non-free software is okay. In fact, users have become so accustomed to it that they tell me what's impossible to do without this. It's unreasonable to suggest that we not use this non-free software. They're taking it for granted, completely missing the goal of freedom. And what about the magazines that talk about the use of the GNU/Linux system and typically call the system Linux? They are filled with advertisements. Many of those are for proprietary software. And each of those advertisements conveys the message, non-free software is good for you. It's so good you might even pay to get it. They call these things value-added packages, which makes a statement about their values. They're saying value practical benefits, not freedom. Now, I disagree with those values, so I have a different term. I call them freedom subtracted packages. Because if you have installed a free operating system, and if you now enjoy the benefits of liberty that we have worked for years so that you could have, those packages give you the opportunity to put on some chains. And then what about the trade shows about the use of the GNU/Linux system? Most of them call the system Linux. I'm very glad that this one, at least in their website, is mostly calling it GNU/Linux, or at least so they promised me, but most of them don't do that. Most of them just call it Linux. And they're all filled with booths promoting non-free software and non-free manuals and system distributions containing non-free software. And this, again, helps to spread the idea that the non-free software is okay. And what about the users groups that are for users of the GNU/Linux system? Most of them call themselves Linux user groups. And most of them invite salesmen to come and make presentations about non-free add-ons, thus endorsing the idea that non-free software is okay. So all of the major institutions associating themselves with the terms Linux and open source are spreading the message that non-free software is okay. Don't bother pushing for freedom in the whole of the software you're using. Stop with this little foothold that we've got. That's the whole job. The job is done. That's the message that they're giving out. This partial freedom that we've obtained so far is enough. Don't bother trying to get more, is what they say. And with that message coming from almost everywhere in our community, it's very important that the people, that these 20 million users get to hear the other idea, the idea which brought the system into existence, the idea that this is a matter of freedom and that it's not good enough to be using a non-free program. And you can help make people aware that this idea even exists if you call the system GNU/Linux. The GNU project is where this idea emanates from. Now, what are some of the challenges that we face where it's going to make a difference what people think? Well, one of them has to do with new hardware products, because the world of hardware does not stand still. Old products are discontinued and new ones are developed. And often the new products don't come with specifications for how to run them. They'll sell you the hardware, but they won't tell you how to use it. Instead, they just release a binary-only driver that you can use it with, if you were willing to use non-free software. And then they say, quote, Linux does support our hardware, unquote. Well, yes, you can run GNU/Linux on that with that hardware if you don't insist on running a completely free version of GNU/Linux. But I call this a problem, not a solution. So how are we going to deal with this? Well, one thing is some people can do reverse engineering and figure out how to write a free driver. Well, that's a lot of work. Are people going to bother? That depends on what they value. If they think that a non-free driver is good enough because it, quote, gets the job done, then they won't bother to do the reverse engineering. So the future of our community depends on what we value. And what can the rest of us do? Well, with 20 million of us, we have substantial market power. If we are determined, if we refuse to buy that hardware, if instead we buy some other hardware which is perhaps more expensive or slower, but is supported by free software, we can put a lot of pressure on those companies to publish their specs. But will we bother to do it? Only if we're aware of the issue. If most of the 20 million users think that the non-free driver is okay, then they won't use their power, and we will lose a battle we could have won. So the future of our community depends on what we value. And then what happens with the other non-free add-ons? Well, the most dangerous kind is when a non-free add-on is used as the basis for developing other free software. And this tends to happen, it seems, with GUI toolkits. The first example was Motif, which is not free software, was never free software, but it was conveniently available to a large number of people. And so they started using it in developing their own free software. And of course, that made it a somewhat paradoxical situation where their software was free but useless because we couldn't run it. You see, if it depends on a non-free program, it can't be a useful extension of a free operating system, even though it itself qualifies as free software. So I asked these people, please change, please rewrite your program to use some other X toolkit. And they said no. So the only thing that could be done, because you see they didn't care enough about freedom. So the future of our community depends on what we value. So the only solution was to develop a free replacement for Motif. Well, people started doing it. It's called Lefty. It took many years, and since about a year ago, it's been working reasonably well. Most of the programs written for Motif would actually run. It took a long time. So we finally got that problem solved, more or less. But meanwhile, a few years ago, another such problem arose with the Qt library. The Qt library was not free software, but it was available gratis. And a lot of people thought that was enough. And in fact, people started basing a large software project on Qt. It was the desktop, KDE. Now, KDE itself was free software, but because it depended on Qt, it was totally useless to the world of free software. You couldn't make it work as part of a free operating system. But the people developing KDE didn't recognize this as a problem. So they were saying, hey, we're having great fun, everybody come join us. And more people, it was like they were down in the bottom of a pit waving their arms and yelling, and so more people would fall down into the pit with them. a big and constantly growing problem, and it requires vigorous counteraction to protect the community from the fate that I could imagine if KDE became thought of as the necessary desktop for GNU/Linux. So to solve the problem, we launched two parallel efforts, which just shows that how important it was. We needed redundant efforts to solve the problem. One of them was the project to develop a free replacement for Qt. The other was GNOME, the GNU desktop. The reason for GNOME was to solve the problem that was developing with KDE and Qt. Anyway, as it happens, GNOME has become a success. The free replacement for Qt, well, they have parts of it working, but not all of it, so it's not usable yet. But we did at least solve the problem. Anyway, about a year ago, Qt was re-released with a new license that made it free software. I am convinced that this was done in response to our vigorous counterattack. Now, I've heard that there's been another change in the Qt license, but I haven't seen the details. Somebody promised to email me the stuff, and there's a story that maybe now it's compatible with the GPL. Well, I hope it is. That would be a big step forward. I'll look at the license and I'll see. In any case, another problem developed of the same kind with Java. Java was so sexy and exciting that a lot of people didn't bother to check the license of the implementation and see that Sun's Java software is not free software. And so a lot of programmers started writing free programs in Java which couldn't possibly be run in a free operating system. Well, people have developed a free implementation of Java. How it doesn't have all the same features that Sun's implementation has, and this means if you're developing a Java program and you want to contribute to our community, you better actively check that you are not using any Sun-only features, because if you do, your program won't run for us. So use the free implementation to do your development, and that way you'll make sure that you use only the features available in the free implementation. Well, as you can see that there's a pattern here. And it's much easier than to get out of these traps. If our community becomes aware enough of this issue, we can decide in advance not to use these non-free add-ons as the basis for any of our work. You know, don't write a program which can only be run using a non-free compiler. Don't write your data in a format which can only be edited or displayed with a non-free program. Pay attention to making sure that not only your work is free, but that it only depends on things that are free, and therefore it can be used in a free system. Perhaps an even bigger danger comes from software patents. There's a petition here against software patents in Europe. I hope every one of you will sign it, and I hope you will ask each of your friends to sign it. It is important to get as many signatures as possible. We need many thousands of them. Please work on this. Please post on your website, make links to the petition. We've got to get support for it. And I hope all of you who are connected with any of the, quote, Linux, unquote, companies will push for these companies to directly ask their customers, please sign this petition. Every one of those companies, future. Company's future is at stake, so it's logical, it's rational, even from a purely selfish point of view, for them to do everything they can to recruit support on this issue. And also, those of you who work for software companies that develop software, if they are not big multinationals, then even if they're developing non-free software or custom software, they're still in danger from software patents. So they too should get involved in this fight, and the sooner the better. But what happens if we lose this fight, which may or may not happen? What are we going to do then? Well, we can still develop free software, but sometimes there will be a feature we can't have. So what's going to happen then? Well, the people who have been convinced by the open source movement that open source would give them more powerful software, they're going to be disappointed. They're going to say, well, you promised me more powerful software, but look, these features are missing. They're patented features, that's why they're missing. So you fail, they're going to say, and they're going to go off and use proprietary software instead. But people who come to agree with the free software movement, who realize that non-free software is taking away their freedom, they're going to say, damn it that those patent holders are stopping me from having this feature and having freedom too. I'm going to choose freedom. I can do without that feature, but I won't do without my freedom. So the future of our community, depends on what we value. We have made a great start. We have a lot of work ahead of us to make freedom prevail. So now I will introduce my alter ego and then take questions.
Install
wholly free operating system. Wholly can be spelled either way. And only install free software on top of that. If you make that moral commitment and live by it, then you too will be a saint in the Church of Emacs, and you may someday have your own halo. People sometimes ask me if my halo is a computer disk. It is not a computer disk, it is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a former existence. I do not know what kind of computer it came from, or what kind of data was stored on it, but I can assure you that no non-free software is People also sometimes ask me if it is a sin in the Church of Emacs to use VI. Or that a free version of VI is not a sin, but it is a penance.